Hello, Thomas. How are you doing?
Hello, Matthew. I'm doing very well. I'm very excited.
Very excited? Why is that, Thomas?
We have a very special guest on the show today.
Oh, really? I swear we're in the Legoland Hotel or something. You're in Billund.
Yes.
Conducting an interview.
Could it be Lego related? Could it be video game related? Could it be both?
I think so, Tom. The studio very near and dear to our hearts.
Indeed.
Jonathan, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hello, guys. I'm Jonathan Smith. I'm Strategic Director at TT Games. I'm very pleased to be with you today.
A pleasure to have you, Jonathan, and thank you for taking the time out to be on our podcast.
We appreciate it very much.
You're very welcome. It's always a great pleasure to come to Billund.
Yes.
And a wonderful treat to stay in the Legoland Hotel.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Lovely place. Nice environment for a podcast.
Indeed. I understand you've been wandering around Legoland today. Is that true, or was that yesterday?
I have. One doesn't wander through Legoland. One drives towards the most extraordinary experiences. And yes, I've been soaked by the log flume today.
Yes.
And I have much more to look forward to even tomorrow. I've also dropped several hundred pounds in the shop.
Okay, so, fair enough.
Yes, I've come out leaner financially than I went in.
Okay, I'd imagine leaner physically as well, maybe a bit more muscle carrying those bags.
That's right. But fair I have had many years of practice, so that those particular muscles are quite well developed.
No, fair enough. Those Lego muscles quite flexed then.
The Lego carrying muscles, yes.
Yes, interesting times. Would you like to tell us a bit about your role at TT?
Sure, I've been with TT since the start. I was originally a designer at Codemasters, before that a journalist working in video game magazines in the UK, and I had the opportunity to work at Lego Company in 2001 when they were looking for new people from the video games industry to come and make a new kind of Lego video game under the leadership of managing director Tom Stone. So I joined the team in Slough, and we started work on a project to discover what could be a new type of Lego game. And we were incredibly privileged to be able to work with one of the teams at Traveller's Tales to build the foundations for and then go on to develop what then became Lego Star Wars. Since then, I've worked on all the Lego games with the teams at Traveller's Tales, their other studio, TT Fusion, and with our external teams as well.
Fantastic. So you mentioned there you were actually at Codemasters. What did you work on back in those days?
I worked in the external development department, so working with some really talented developers from across Europe and in the UK. But in particular, I did spend quite a lot of time working with Bohemia Interactive on the first Operation Flashpoint. That was, a great pleasure. They were a fantastic team, and they've done so well since then.
That's very cool. Yeah. Any magazines we may know as well from our hazy days of gaming in the past?
I did work on a couple of magazines that are not so well remembered. I started work on a magazine called Mega about the Mega Drive.
Yes. Oh, familiar with it?
That's right. Are you really reviewing pinball games and platformers?
Okay.
And doing tips, cheats, and that was a great way to start. Playing Micro Machines 2 every lunchtime. And columns. Yeah. Do you remember 5-player columns? On Mega Drive, it had you could plug in the multi-tap and play with multiple controllers. That was great competitive local gameplay on that console. I subsequently freelanced for PC Gamer and Edge and Arcade Magazine and the usual sort of stuff.
Aces.
And did some. Aces was a word that I signed off one of my first reviews back in.
Coincidental.
Matt used it a lot.
1990.
Profusely.
And yes, I had also had the pleasure of working and doing some reviews for a magazine called N64 Magazine.
Oh, wow.
Doing complete solutions for games like Blast Corps and stuff like that. It's one of the slightly forgotten but best magazines.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
You've just
my favourite magazine.
What do you remember about it? What was so special about it?
I remember that it was quite playfully written. It was quite fun. There was characters. It was the characters who wrote for it were always quite well represented. I don't know.
I think the main thing about it was because the N64 had a very limited portfolio of games, particularly in the UK, as a games console of Japanese origin. It took great pains to really get the most out of each game.
Yeah.
So rather than just dash off for a review 1 month and then move on to the next swathe of new releases, they had to write month after month about the same games. And that that gave cause for the editor, Jonathan Davis, to make a rule that every game that they reviewed, they would have had to have completed to 100%.
Mm-hmm.
So that placed a really interesting sort of burden on the reviewer, because some of those games were really hard to complete to 100%.
I mean, you could
perhaps finish the story.
And some you probably wouldn't want to.
Well, that's indeed true, which is you enter a sort of a zone,
yeah.
which is exciting. But yeah, it was incredibly thorough and utterly rigorous and quite playful.
Yeah, I remember a Clay Fighter review, something that's having red hot pokers in your eyes or something like that. It was a synopsis of how terrible it was to play Clay Fighter 63 in a third, was it? I can't remember now.
Similar along those lines.
I haven't had the displeasure myself. I avoided it thanks to the magazine. So.
But you had an N64, you remember some great games on that.
That was like my first real foray into video gaming. Before that, I had a Master System, CDI, that was a bit of a misstep.
Cool. And then how did you come to have a CDI?
My uncle had one. He supported everything that failed, like Betamaxes, CDI, 3DOs. Mm-hmm. And he convinced my parents it was a good idea to get one.
What did you play on CDI?
It's a great game.
I only remember Seventh Guest. I don't know what else
it was. The Apprentice was a 2D platform game by the Vision Factory, which was very good. Little Divil, I played that.
I remember
Kefa.
Don't remember that.
That was a sci-fi shooter thing. But I do have fond memories of the CDI. Everyone else had a Mega Drive. I would love been playing Micro Machines at the time, but instead I was, because Micro Machines was on the CDI.
Was it really?
Yes,
really?
The first Micro Machines, yeah. And it had little CG introductions on the start of the races, but it was incredibly slow. Years later, when I played the Mega Drive version, I was amazed at how fast it was. I never knew Micro Machines to be like that, having played the inferior version, I suppose.
Wow, goodness.
There you go. Yeah. Bit of a off track there.
Nostalgia trip for all of us.
Yeah.
So I guess you moved then on from games journalism and from then to Codemasters. How did you end up starting Giant Interactive? Where did that come from?
So we commissioned Traveller's Tales to make LEGO Star Wars while we were here at LEGO Company.
Yes.
But LEGO Company had many other priorities than video games. Video games was quite low on its agenda, particularly at the time when it had a real need to sort of focus on the brick.
Yes.
And we wanted LEGO Star Wars to really speak to video game players as a pure video game, as a video game that came from a place that loved video games and understood video games, not in any way to be perceived as another licensed property or a game that was just for kids, something that really understood what its responsibilities were to be a video game. We felt that could only be achieved by creating a new company that was a video game publisher, to see through the development of that, then to take that to market.
It certainly speaks to me. I mean, obviously, with the Super Nintendo and the Mega Drive, there were some very good licensed games, particularly the Disney ones. But
yes, of course, some of which were developed by other teams at Traveller's Tales.
Yeah,
exactly.
Like Pinocchio.
Mickey Mania as well.
Mickey Mania.
Mickey Mania is the one that everyone remembers, absolutely.
Yeah. And obviously, especially during the PS1 and notoriously Game Boy games as well, around that PS2 era, licensed games had kind of been dragged through the dirt a bit, and I remember being a boy and getting my hands on the first LEGO Star Wars game and it just being kind of blown away by it. Just
that's wonderful. So how old were you when you played LEGO Star Wars?
What year was it released?
It was released in 2005.
2005.
May 2005, 6 weeks before the release of Episode 3.
I would have been 15, but even then, I felt a lot younger, which is weird.
Was that on PlayStation 2 that you played that, or was it on GameCube?
I had it on the GameCube.
Cool, yeah.
I had an Xbox.
Good.
Yeah, how about that?
Yeah.
I played it a lot later, though. I didn't. I came to LEGO games rather late myself. Mm-hmm. But it was a nice surprise when I did.
Just squeezing every ounce of entertainment from the CDI.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But, he had a similar opinion on the CDI that he must 100% every game.
Absolutely,
and
yeah.
So he was getting the most out of it. So talk about Star Wars then. I know, obviously, LEGO has many IPs now, but that was kind of the first thing LEGO had ever done, right, in terms of IPs, and then
I don't think it's the first inbound license you ever had here at LEGO. In the LEGO Ideas House today, the sort of the LEGO Museum, I saw a Pluto, the Disney Pluto dog character made out of wood from the days back before the 50s when you were still making wooden LEGO toys. So there were inbound Disney licenses going way back. And, of course, you had Winnie the Pooh. Who else would you have had before Star Wars? I'm sure there are other examples. I'm remembering Bob the Builder being vaguely contemporary with that.
I don't think we ever did Bob the Builder, did we?
Yeah, and Duplo.
Aha!
No, you definitely did.
Yes,
you are
correct.
Oh, wow.
I completely forgot about that.
Yeah. We're being schooled, Matthew.
Before that. But you're right to say that LEGO Star Wars certainly made a massive impact.
Yes, this is
as
true.
As an inbound license, and became certainly for some time the best-selling theme. And for us, it was the perfect blend. It gave us the universe within which we could bring all the qualities that we loved about LEGO, together with the qualities that, as games players and fans of, you know, entertainment, gave them a sort of an emotional resonance, and an audience as well that we thought was what the game deserved, because we were with Star Wars, you know, activating fun with the world's favorite characters and stories at the time in such a well-known universe, and that also the opportunity to play with that universe in a way that people hadn't done so before, which you could only do with the power and permission that you got with LEGO, was incredibly special.
Yeah. The humour just shone out of that. The first, I loved how he didn't speak at the beginning, and what you could do with that silent humour was the ideas that you had for that game. I thought were really fantastic. Mm. You know, really impressed. Obviously, the first thing that really impressed me about the game was the humour.
Testament to the team. A lot of the humour comes from the character animations, the way that they jump and fall, and then sometimes the way they feel and the sound effects around them as well. But you're right. There was also a lot in the way that the stories were set up and messed around with and retold, and we did decide, you know, right from the start that we didn't want to use voice acting, and that again gave us permission to retell the stories in a way that became distinctive, but also was essentially and inevitably humorous as well, and sort of had an ironic take on something, but that also a very reverent take as well. Yeah. We were always entirely authentic. It was very important that we had a great and supportive relationship from Lucasfilm and LucasArts throughout, that everything was correct, that we had got the right music and the right sound effects, and we did capitalize and spell people's names correctly. That was really important, because only by being authentic and sort of knowing the rules could we then break some of them and have things happen in a LEGO world that you hadn't seen in the movies before.
Mm-hmm. Definitely added something fresh to Star Wars as well.
Yeah, and another thing that felt fresh, at least to me at the time, was what's become a staple of the LEGO games now, local co-op.
Yes, absolutely. That was very important. I mean, you know that a LEGO value is people sharing together and playing together and creating and exhibiting what they've done. And so we wanted to have opportunities for siblings, you know, brothers and sisters, parents and children to play together. That was integral to the concept for LEGO Star Wars, and it gave it an arcade feel as well. You know,
definitely.
That there weren't many games around at the time that were like that.
No, I guess there was kind of almost more of a focus on realism and this kind of idea, and obviously we'd had things like GoldenEye on the Nintendo 64 previously, and kind of my local co-op feelings of the PlayStation 2 with things like Time Splitters.
Time Splitters 2, great games, and GoldenEye obviously developed by Free Radical with Time Splitters. Fantastic experiences, absolutely. But shooting experiences.
Yeah, exactly.
And you had racing games for competitive local play. I can't think of much else co-op. As for sports games, you know, you could play FIFA or Madden cooperatively, couldn't you, on the same screen?
Of course, beat-em-ups as well.
Beat-em-ups, that's right. But we hadn't had a scrolling co-op beat-em-up for a while.
No.
I mean, I remember Streets of Rage 2 on Mega Drive was a great... That was, the first home co-op scrolling beat-em-up that I played, so that was wonderful.
Yeah. My first memories of that, believe it or not, Double Dragon 2 on the NES with my brother, and then Turtles in Time.
You know what mine was? Mutant Rampage on the CDI.
Cool.
Wow.
Brilliant.
Oh, dear.
You should really write a book on the CDI.
I went back and played all the good games later, you know. I went back and got a big... Oh, wow. I got a Mega Drive eventually. And so I was able to play Streets of Rage then. Hey, Mutant Rampage ain't too bad. It's
cool.
Pretty good.
Fair. And then obviously, once you'd established LEGO Star Wars as a game and then going from the prequel trilogy and then into the original trilogy, you were then kind of given the options to branch out? Or was that something you'd always decided you wanted to do, to take these forward into other IPs?
Yeah, we always knew that that LEGO can be anything.
Of course.
Anything is possible with LEGO. Any universe can enter, can have the LEGO lens applied to it. Mm. So those options became incredibly exciting to think, what other stories can we tell? And the answers to that question were very simple. Isn't it? What other stories do we love and do we think are relevant for the broadest possible audience, and in particular for a young audience, and for their parents as well? So it was very natural. We went to DC Comics and Batman. We went to Marvel. We went to Pirates of the Caribbean. That we went to Indiana Jones, and you know, we based on, I think, the power of Lego, what everyone knows and loves Lego, the affinity everyone has for the brand, and the quality bar that we've set with Lego Star Wars as well. We've been lucky enough to have had very productive conversations with licensors since then.
Yeah, fantastic. I mean, there is obviously, like we've talked about, there's humor in the games, but there's not too much humor. It isn't overbearing.
What would too much humor be, and what would the effect of having too much humor be?
Would you just not
be able to play the game because you'd be laughing so much? Do you think it'd be dangerous? Would people get hurt?
Perhaps they would. Perhaps, you know, as you talked about earlier in a presentation you gave us, perhaps these children in stock photographs that seem to be having a whale of the time would just become uncontrollable.
Yeah,
perhaps, you know, in the later cases of the Wii, maybe those Wii emotes would have been forced to fly off their hands because they wouldn't have been able to control them.
Did you use the Wii at all? The motion control in the Wii in any of the PT
absolutely.
Games?
That's how you can attack in the Wii version of Lego Star Wars 2 and Complete Saga.
See, I've not played them, so I don't know. But
Sorry, Complete Saga, Lego Star Wars 2 wasn't on Wii. Saga was on Wii. Yeah,
nice.
That's how you attack and in games since then.
Okay.
I don't think we have too much humour. You're right. Thank goodness.
Yes.
It's the nightmare scenario.
But it is the nightmare scenario. Can you imagine? It would be a world gone mad. But just this idea of a family-friendly game is where I was going to segue from the idea of too much humour, and it doesn't go too far, was the point, I guess, I was trying to make. Not too much humour.
Well, I'm not sure about going too far. We always advocated it as saying, you know, we want to be fun, but there's a point where it would become silly.
Yes.
Like, it wouldn't... I think, again, I'll stress the point about authenticity. Like, it's like these stories and these characters are serious for us. We're all fans of the properties that we work with. And if we weren't, if we didn't, you know, have genuine emotional feelings about, you know, Harry's adventure in Harry Potter, or even, you know, about the superheroes in the DC universe, if we hadn't, you know, really thought about that and cared about that, then it would be easy to do these games in a way that didn't matter.
Yes.
We really work hard to try and avoid that.
And of course, as is done in the toys as well, you take a great Lego interpretation with these things, but as you say, you do treat them with the respect they deserve. These are huge franchises, these are huge characters that are sometimes larger than life, but to put that in a way that's easy to decode for a child and to play along with is fantastic. We've moved through fantastic IPs you guys had. Recently announced Lego Batman 3, which
we're all
very looking forward to playing.
Yeah, it's going to be amazing.
It definitely will be. If 2 was anything to go by, you know. And then that world and a free open world expanded upon later in the Marvel game. Looking forward to it very much. You are a man who has 3 boys, one of who has now become a developer himself. We had the chance to meet Sam earlier and play his game Space Pants.
How did you find Space Pants?
Infuriatingly difficult. We were all there earlier in the office, and we were all there, sat round, playing it and trying to beat each other's score. And then I saw Mike Bithell's score of 49 seconds. And I was like,
It was a clever piece of design. I think quite unique, in fact, because I've not played a game that's quite like Space Pants before.
Oh, good.
I don't think the idea of something coming from the middle of the screen that you had to avoid. Now, I played a lot of Endless Runners, you know, scrolling on forever, but I thought that was quite a unique way of doing it.
I'll tell Sam, he'll be very pleased. It was a massive privilege for both of us today to come to speak here at Lego, and I wanted to tell a story about our history with Lego games, but also a personal story. Sam, who's my middle son, son of 3, was born in the same year that we started development on Lego Star Wars, the same year we first initiated that contact with Traveller's Tales. He's now 12 years old, so he's been born into a world since Wikipedia, since Grand Theft Auto, which came out in 2001. He is a new generation of sort of digital native, and his journey over those 12 years has been actually to find conventional school unbearable. We've taken him out of school. It wasn't the right environment for him. But he's been learning a lot through video games. He's obviously, as you would expect, played a lot of Minecraft, but other great games as well, like Terraria or or Starbound recently as well, and many, many other games, and games that increasingly have enabled him to be creative.
Yes.
And the final outcome of that, and this is the punchline of the presentation that I gave, is that just this month he's now released actually his first game that he developed on the App Store. As you say, it's called Space Pants, and being able to share the stage with Mike Bithell today, who's given him a masterclass in the use of Twitter. Sam is right now discovering that that's an amazingly fun game to play, trying to get people to hear more about his game. But thank you for speaking so kindly about it. I'm glad you could play it. It's genuinely like surprisingly fun, and it was wonderful to see him go through the process of deciding exactly what he wanted to make. Mm. Exactly how it's going to be different to the other games that he liked.
Yeah.
And then to see him just be able to do that, because the tools that are available now for people to make games and then get them distributed to an audience are fantastic.
Mm. That's a catchy title.
It's exactly the title you'd expect from a 12-year-old boy.
Perfect.
But I mean, it's got that addictive quality to it as well. Something, it kind of reminded me a bit of Vlambeer's Super Crate Box. Just this idea of you die and you're just like, okay, I'm going to do this again.
That's an incredibly flattering comparison. I should point out that it's on iOS, so it's on iPhone and iPads as well, and downloadable from the App Store.
It is indeed. You should go and check it out. It is 99 pence, I believe.
It is. That's right.
That is a bargain price for such a stand-up game.
Well, we can guarantee you'll have a lot of fun. Hopefully not too much fun.
Too much fun, no. We must restrict these things like humour.
It's just humorous enough.
It is just humorous enough, yes. What do you think about this world where young developers are able to develop their own games and where kids are increasingly more growing up with independent developers around them and being able to see that small teams are able to create games now? What do you think this will hold for the future of gaming?
So putting the power to make games in the hands of children is the most important thing. Not because games are necessarily the most important thing, but because the act of crafting interactivity, thinking about an audience, and then putting together and architecting and releasing a product exposes you to so many dynamics that are going to be relevant for life in the world, that are already relevant for life in the world, affect how you start thinking about the way that you receive information, that people communicate in societies, that you relate to a sense of civic, political, cultural, all these things. We have a nexus in interactivity, and to take control of that space at a young age, where you're still making up your mind about what sort of a world you're encountering, is, I think, incredibly empowering and important. It's great that there are moves across the world, but in particular, as I know, in the UK, to help give children that sense of empowerment while at school as well, but also out of school. So in principle, I think that's incredibly important. And the tools that are being made available to people who want to make their games now, and the support that's given to them through online communities and tutorials and YouTube, is a great ecology to help people learn how to do that and to experiment and to develop. And what I think is, every week something makes me incredibly thankful for this. The culture amongst people who make games, the developers, the people like Mike, we couldn't give too much time to Sam, and other people that we've met as we go to shows, or Sam starts communicating with them online, the generosity that they have, to the spirit that they have to want more people to appreciate what the capabilities of video games are, because video games can do so much more than they've been allowed to do yet. There's so much more to discover. And the sense that lots of people want this medium to be developed in new ways with new people and by new people is great. Unless you think otherwise. Unless you think children should be prevented from making games. Yes. It's hard to take the opposing view, isn't it?
Just this idea of being able to create something, and it's something I never really twigged on as a kid.
But you were making things with Lego, I presume?
Oh yeah, of course. But it's still, I talk to some children now, and the very idea that Thomas and I design minifigures, that very idea that there is someone behind the minifigure, and the fact that there is someone designing this thing that they almost take for granted as part of their play experience, and the fact that Lego models themselves and then games are designed, and there are
people, things, humans that they could be themselves, exactly, or be better than, probably, hopefully.
Oh, definitely. I have no doubt in my mind. And you just see the spark, that recognition, that almost awakening of design thinking, that things like chairs and toys and everything else around them is something that was crafted by a person somewhere. Like, that idea was conceived, and I guess it sparks an idea of creative thinking within them.
I think it's very important. I mean, one of the values of Lego and one of the missions of Lego is to inspire the builders of tomorrow, isn't it? And
of
you
course.
Can inspire them with the process and the sheer, like, kinesthetic pleasure of playing with Lego. Like, makes you build. You have to build. You find yourself building. But then, and that's wonderful, and that is inspiring. I think then to go on and support the builders of tomorrow, to actually show them that there is a route whereby they can do this in the world, you know, that people respect, that makes sense, that attaches them to a culture, and that some of them even perhaps, you know, can earn revenue from and support themselves and their families to some extent, or perhaps entirely, is really valuable.
Agreed. Wholeheartedly.
Incredibly inspiring toy, Lego. Even though, you know, I didn't build much as a kid, I was playing with the minifigures and thinking up stories and characters and assigning these characters to the figures, and I was looking at things from different angles, like I would watch a film, you know, coming from that angle and such. And so I think Lego is great because it not only inspires builders and construction and such, but it also inspires filmmakers or storytellers. And so
did the same. Like, I had a lineup of minifigures which admittedly only had 3 or 4 different heads between them, but with different torsos and different accessories. All of these characters between me and my friends had names.
Yeah, you can pile on heads and have a three-headed guy.
You can have a three-headed
guy. You know,
guy.
And I was like, it's cool that you can do that in the Lego games as well. You can create your own figures. And for me, that was a big part of Lego.
The character customizer.
Yeah.
Absolutely. We never allowed you to stack heads, actually, which
you know, yeah,
is
it's a shame.
Opportunity, perhaps.
It is a bit.
Perhaps.
I'd love that.
And looking forward into the future of games where this technology and this accessibility is being put in the hands of people. What is it excites you about games? Is it VR? Is it new consoles? Is it the fact that almost now we're being told that tablets and smartphones are in the hands of almost everyone?
It's the broadening of the audience.
Yes.
I mean, the technology always changes. There is always new technology. Stuff we take for granted now didn't exist 2 years ago, didn't exist 4 years ago. There will always be exciting new things. Touch screens, and then, as you say, VR. Social mechanics, enabled through connectivity, incredibly exciting. Asymmetric co-op gameplay is something that I'm particularly interested in with new devices. But I think the key point is about broadening the audience.
Yes.
And enabling people to play games in different ways and for different reasons. And by bringing in new people to make games, to find that there are new ways, there are new places for games to exist and new stories for them to tell.
Mm.
I think that's kind of what you touched upon with Sam, this idea of people who necessarily wouldn't have thought about games before are now thinking, oh, this could be a fun mechanic, and we are getting originality in spades from indie developers that perhaps are missing in some AAA titles. Just this, a new mechanic or a new way of looking at something that then completely changes the game, and I think it'll be fascinating to watch.
It's very true, and you know, over the millennia of cultural development across the world, there are many interesting things. I think we'll all acknowledge that.
Yes.
And only the tiniest proportion of those interesting things and feelings and attitudes have been embodied so far in video games.
Definitely.
And there is a whole lots of new stuff to explore.
Of course, and I mean, it's technically, if we compare it to something like literature or film, it is a medium very much in its infancy. There, the sky is the limit as far as creativity is concerned. And
well, no, we'll definitely go beyond the sky.
Yes, hopefully.
Space pants, we're already in space. So.
This is true.
It's an absolute pleasure talking to Jonathan today.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you. Nice to be reminded of the CDI, thank you.
Yeah, pleasure. I can talk about 3DO as well, but maybe we'll leave that for next time.
I'm sure you can get many emails from Thomas regarding his CDI topics, if you would like that.
That would be great. Subscribe.
Yeah, is there anything you'd like to plug? Obviously, Space Pants available on the App Store.
No, just I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to sit here in the Legoland Hotel. And I enjoyed talking to you and your colleagues earlier today. Thanks very much.
Fantastic.
Thank you
very much. You can find us at the usual channels, facebook.com/ Tom and Matt Attack, on Twitter @TMAcast, and like and subscribe in iTunes and Stitcher. Until next week, guys, game on.
Game on.